This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. Welcome to the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and of course, Julian Ng is in the studio with me as well. And together, we have a bunch of things coming up on the show. For instance, what's in store later, we're going to be looking at financial news that includes whether petrol prices will go down with oil prices, as well as cramped living spaces.
Yes, but first, financial dashboards. What are they? How can they help you? Today, we have Rajan Devadasan, who's CEO of RD Wealth Creation, to talk to us about it. So, Rajan, financial dashboard, what is it and what does it do?
Hi, Julian. Thanks again for having me back. Maybe the best way to understand what I mean by a financial planning dashboard is to first consider the other type of dashboard we're familiar with, the one in a car.
Right.
So a warning light in your car's dashboard is not something that, you know, you should ignore. I think for those who actually watch Big Bang Theory, one of the key plot points for a long time was a warning light on the dashboard of a car that was actually left unattended to for a long time until the car basically crashed.
To dire consequences.
Very bad idea. So anyway, when competent adults drive, they have a tendency to look at their dashboard indicators to keep tabs on speed, fuel level, engine temperature, and possibly even flashing warning indicators. Hopefully you don't get too many of those. So in personal finance, I believe it makes sense for adults to construct their own financial planning dashboard to track what the relevant financial planning dials might indicate.
What's in this financial dashboard? What exactly are you tracking?
If I can take a step back, I think it's easier to understand that. When we talk about financial planning, the two most important financial planning statements are the net worth statement, which is like a human balance sheet, and your cash flow statement, which measures basically cash in and cash out. So each statement has two parts. You'd have assets, what you own, and liabilities, what you owe. Very good. Comprising your net worth statement, and cash inflow and cash outflow comprising your cash flow statement. So if you think about it, if you construct your own financial planning dashboard, you really only need to have four dials, and if you really want to get fancy about it, maybe two rectangular digital displays. These are all thought experiments. So if you play along with me, the way I like to think about it is if you have a variable colored backlight for each of the two digital displays, then I think the backlights for those rectangular displays can range from anything, say, from bright red to white to bright green. Those listening may actually eventually want to do all this on paper if they can remember it. If they can't, just download the podcast, listen again. After that, they may actually want to replicate what we're talking about on an Excel spreadsheet, which will make it much easier. Now, as I said, the first pair of dials are tied to cash flow. The second pair, net worth. One of the most useful things an individual can do is to envisage his or her personal cash flow pattern as a video clip covering a period of maybe one calendar month. But the net worth statement should really be, or net worth statement measurement should actually be, measurements should be seen as a series of photographs, perhaps taken at monthly intervals. So to track your own cash flow and net worth on your personal dashboard, below the descriptions cash flow and net worth, you put in your relevant dials, cash inflow, cash outflow, and assets and liabilities. And then directly below your cash flow dials would be the rectangular panel, color-coded, which would show that month's cash inflow minus cash outflow. Obviously, if your cash inflow is less than your outflow, you're in trouble. And therefore, because it's negative and it's ominous, you might want to have a red backlight. And if it's zero, meaning your cash inflow exactly matches your cash outflow, you're doing what Robert Kiyosaki would describe as redlining, then your backlight would be white. But if your cash flow is positive, in other words, you've got more cash coming in than going out, then you're green, you're healthy green. And I think your backlight could be a healthy green as well.
So you're doing this on a month-to-month basis. Do you combine all the months, accumulate all the months?
A cash flow statement is really a video clip, if you like. So it doesn't really matter whether you measure your cash flow over a week or a month or a quarter or a year. It's really up to you. But the way I'm envisaging this, people should actually run their financial dashboard on a monthly basis so they can see whether they're actually getting ahead or not. So if they manage their cash flow intelligently, and they manage to keep it healthily green, then because there is a cash flow surplus, that surplus at the end of the month must go somewhere by definition, even if it's just inside a piggy bank or you stuff it in your pillow, most likely it'll just stay in the bank. It's sitting somewhere. Now, remember, on the net worth side, you've got assets and liabilities. By virtue of generating a cash flow surplus, you automatically strengthen your net worth. So it doesn't really matter, but I think for practical purposes, you might want to do it on a month-by-month basis. So if people can understand the very close connection between your cash flow statement and your net worth statement, you will realize that, coming back to the dashboard, the net worth dials on the panel represent assets and liabilities, and the panel would be the actual monetary amount, your assets minus your liabilities, the value. So a negative net worth would be would show up as a worrisome red backlight. A net worth of exactly zero, you know, let's say you have a half a million ringgit in assets and exactly half a million ringgit in liabilities of different sorts, then your net worth is zero, white backlight, and what you want actually is a healthy, green, positive net worth. So as you track your cash flow and your net worth regularly, I believe people will be motivated to regulate their earning activities and their expenditure patterns to improve their financial health. The truth of the matter is, for most of us, unless people, you know, some friendly ancestor tends to leave us something in the will, most of us basically, if we're going to have anything, we're going to have to work hard for it.
Okay, I just want to go back and spend the last few minutes discussing the interpretation of the financial dashboard, because here you are doing that activity that you recommended and color coding your cash flow statement and your net worth statement. How should one act after doing all those things? If it's a bunch of reds, if it's a bunch of greens or whites.
I'm glad you asked. If you have a young person who has joined the workforce or, you know, starts a business at a fairly relatively young age, then the truth of the matter is, if your cash flow dials and the display suggest that you're running negative, you obviously need to do two things. You need to increase your income and you need to reduce your expenses. For people who are probably under the age of 35, I would imagine that the smartest way to do that is to just work harder. If your colleagues end up working 8 or 9 hours a day, quite frankly, I think you need to put your nose to the grindstone and be willing to work 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 hours a day. Again, not popular advice, but working harder is a good way to increase your active income. As you cross 35, you find that your energy levels will probably start to drop a little bit. And by that time, you've picked up enough cerebral equity, I think, to be able to realize...
That's a nice term. I like that.
Cerebral equity.
I got to use that one.
No charge. Feel free. Okay. But I think you then get to the point where if you want to continue the upward trajectory of your active income, you actually need to start working smarter, not just harder. And I think both the young and the old need to understand this. Everyone needs to work hard. Everyone needs to work smart. But generally speaking, I think if you are young and you're having real difficulty making ends meet, work hard first and then get the dials in place, get the displays green.
Checking your spending habit can also have a huge impact on the cash flow statements, right?
Absolutely. Like I said, there are two parts, cash in, cash out. And if you've got, shall we just say, very well-developed appetites, in fact, so well-developed that your current ability to earn can't keep up, either earn more or spend less. You know, there really isn't anything new under the sun. This advice has been given to intelligent people concerned about their personal economics for thousands and thousands of years. Nothing's changed.
I remember the interview we had last year, actually, almost a year ago, about sometimes you need to spend on certain things. Some liabilities, there are good liabilities and there are bad liabilities, right? And there may be some reds, but that's not necessarily bad, right?
Oh, not at all. Yeah. When you look far more closely at your net worth statement, you've actually got assets and liabilities, correct?
Yeah.
That's basic. But when you drill down, you will actually find that there are such things as good assets and bad assets, such things as good liabilities and bad liabilities. In an age of relativism, to be able to say the words good and bad actually will raise the hackles of some people. But here, I think there is a very clear definition of what is good and what is bad, whether on the asset side or the liability side. If you have a good asset, over time, it enriches you. If you have a bad asset, over time, it impoverishes you. Classic examples of good assets might be blue chip stocks that you own that pay you dividends. investment property that you may own that you can rent out, and over time the tenants help pay for the mortgage that you've got. Classic example of a bad liability, of a bad asset, which could also be tied to a bad liability, would be, you know, buying too much car too early. Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily the case that if you are seeing a bunch of reds for your net worth statement in the short term, is that necessarily a case to press the panic button?
No. If your net worth statement is red in the short term for the right reasons, but your cash flow statement is green, you're okay. Because by definition, over time, the cash flow statement the cash flow surpluses that you generate on a month-by-month basis will actually translate into a strengthening of the net worth. But the other way around is not so healthy. Just because you've got a positive net worth, if you've got negative cash flow, God help you, because your positive net worth over time will be whittled down. And what you want to do, what you want to see through the course of your adult life is an improvement in your net worth.
And that was Rajan Devadasan, CEO of RD Wealth Creation, talking to us about how you can use financial dashboards to improve your financial life. And here is Lee Chui Lin bringing us, as usual, tidings from the world of personal finance.
Indeed. And the first letter is very personal because, as I mentioned, it's a letter. And it was written at the end of the year to Malaysia Kini. Lau Bing wrote, "There is no rationale to sell RON 95 at more than RM1.06 a litre." This is in light of the drop in crude oil prices recently. And so basically Lau Bing is arguing that this plan to reduce petrol prices in January 2016 by 10 sen by 10 sen for RON 95 and 20 sen for RON 97 still makes it expensive, and that these new prices are neither relative nor realistic to current low crude oil prices.
Yeah, there's some secret formula that the government uses to actually translate oil prices and oil cost into petrol prices. I say, you know, this kind of thing should be freed up, like what they do in the States, where each company decides what they want to charge the consumer. And interestingly,
and then the consumer decides which company they want to pump with.
Exactly. If you wanted to wait outside a petrol kiosk just to wait for the price to drop, you know, it's your prerogative to do that. And interestingly, Lau Bing wrote in at a time not too long ago that when oil price was at $36 a barrel. Today, it's pushing below $30 a barrel. And that's, you know, we think it's $6, but actually that's a 20% crash in oil prices, right? And some people are even talking about $10 or $20 in prices. And this should be something that benefits us. We should have more money in our pockets so that, you know, we can spend on other things or invest and take care of ourselves.
And not have to fuss over how much it costs to drive our car. And from the Malaysian Insider, say goodbye to cheap goreng pisang satay and tom yum in 2016. And this is coming as petty food traders grapple not only with the goods and services tax, but also the recent string of price hikes, and I suppose in some ways the lack of price drops, which we just spoke about. I think for much of 2015, food traders have absorbed as much of the cost as they could because they didn't want to burden customers with that sharp increase. They didn't want to lose customers. And also because half the time customers are regulars, so they just don't, you know, they can't
Don't question it.
They can't stomach it. You see what I did there?
Yeah.
But
puns.
Well, some say calm down. Well, some say they have no choice. Others say they'll try to continue absorbing the costs, but I don't know.
Yeah, this relates to petrol prices again, right? But prices are so sticky. They just go up, but they don't come down. I want to see the day when petrol prices actually reduce the cost of all traders and everyone else. And I want to see prices actually coming off as a result of cheaper costs. But yet again, I don't know. I don't know if this is like a rigged game in the sense that the government controls so many things, the tolls, the GST, and it all adds up. So it's hard for prices to come down. And I think we should go back to ringgit and cents recommendations, and even some recommendations from our beloved ministers, right, saying that perhaps you should eat in and cook on your own.
And for some people, though, that's not an option. Our last story is kind of a sad one. And it is also via the Malaysian Insider. And it's family of 16 cram into one room flat, sleep in shifts. And it tells the story of Abdul Wahab Musa's family of 16 living in a one room flat at a people's housing project in Sentul, KL. And he's been living there for the past 4 years, making a living from selling drinks, snacks and fruits illegally near Dataran Merdeka. And these drinks drinks, snacks and fruits, I presume, will also rise in price. I mean, corresponding with our previous story.
Yeah, it's definitely a hard life for him. He earns 300 to 400 ringgit a day, and after deducting costs, that comes up to about 50 to 60 ringgit a day for a family of, like, you know, more than half a dozen. It's hard. It's very hard.
Interestingly, he said despite the higher cost of living in the capital and a debt of about 3,000 ringgit and nearly 2 years of unpaid rental to this flat, he comes from Malacca, but he says he's better off staying in KL because he has no property or land back in his hometown, and earnings in the kampung be more or less the same.
Yeah, these are the kind of things that push people to the street. I don't know about the statistics of homeless people in Malaysia or in KL, right? But certainly a lot of money sloshing around in the world, pushing up property prices all over the world, it certainly poses a problem for housing.
And they're also talking about how essentially in order to, you know, break the cycle of poverty, education is needed. And but in order to properly educate the children, they're going to have to take them away because a one room flat sleeping in shifts is just not a conducive environment to study. And I found that very sad. And now let's look at a message from our sponsor, OCBC Bank. It's a new year. It's time for resolutions. For those of us lucky enough to have them, you know, we will also be talking about bonuses. Surveys show that financial resolutions are among the top three resolutions globally, surprise, surprise. And for January, as we head into Chinese New Year month, we're talking about saving one's bonus.
Yes, you can either squander away all your bonus or spend it on the latest smart device or fashionable clothing item, or you can save it. So getting more out of your savings is important, not only because it accumulates money for your financial objectives, but also it rests on one very important financial concept, and this is the concept of compounding.
So compounding simply means getting interest on your interest. It sounds simple enough. You know, if you save 100 ringgit, the interest is 4% a year. At the end of the first year, your savings account will have 104 ringgit. Next year, you get 4% on top of that. And then your balance at the end of year two will be 108 ringgit and 16 cents. So precise. Simply put, you get interest on the latest balance in your savings account.
So now what happens when you save 100 ringgit a month at 4% a year for the next 10 years? Your monthly savings plus interest will grow your bank balance to 14,725 ringgit by the end of year 10. That's the effects of compounding at work.
So the first thing you should be doing to fulfill OCBC's resolution number one of saving your bonuses is to appreciate these effects. And of course, investing is also a form of savings. It's not just about putting money into bank accounts, although I think a lot of people think that's what it is.
A lot of people do that.
Yeah. But bank accounts can also be a sort of holding account for your money before you decide how to invest or spend it. And then while you decide, you earn some interest.
A habit that people usually have is to leave balances lying around in many bank accounts, maybe as a legacy of, you know, having a few jobs and a few property loans. But it's actually much better to consolidate balances from various bank accounts into one account. This is so that you can easily monitor your savings and put them into an account that gives you the most competitive savings rates.
So would you say one should save all your bonus? Is that how it works?
Well, the definition of savings has to be expanded, right? It's not just putting money into the bank account, but it can also mean investing.
Right. But broadly speaking, say I get a bonus and I'm really happy with it. You know, does that mean I have to spend? I have to save it all? I mean,
no, you don't. You can consume some of it. It really is a question of how much bonus you're getting. If you're not getting a lot, I don't know, perhaps, you know, just spend it. I don't know. Whatever makes you happy.
Would you give me a percentage of how much I should be saving, how much I should be spending?
It's very different, right? It's a bad year. It's going to be a bad year. And perhaps some companies would pay 1 month bonus, let's say. And if your salary is 3,000, you get 3,000 bucks. But if you are lucky enough to be in a very successful company and they give you, say, 6 months bonus, you can spend that 1 month and save the other 5 months, right? But for the guy who gets 1 month, perhaps, you know, that all goes into cost of living.
Yeah. Incidentally, OCBC also has what's called the easy resolution. Be optimistic, forecast the month you're going to get your bonus, and then set a reminder for you to save or invest that. They're also offering an interest rate of 4.3% for a 15-month fixed deposit. They also have someone called Mr. Coach who can advise you how to immediately put your bonus to work. And to access Mr. Coach, check out ocbc.com.my/Mr. Coach/ bonus. And that is it from us this week on Ring It and Sense, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.